We are supposed to be learning Hilchos Shabbos, and I thought, given that we just came off of Yom Tov, and that I'm not going to be here on Tuesday, as I mentioned, so I just wanted to do one standalone shiur that we don't have to have multiple follow-ups for, and that is about Havdalah. Havdalah is also a very important part of Hilchos Shabbos, and obviously, as we know, we just had Shabbos and Yom Tov, so Havdalah was relevant there, not only because when Shabbos is over, we make Havdalah, but when Yom Tov is over, as we know, we make Havdalah as well. So let us get into the sugya of Havdalah, and let's learn some halacha that is relevant to all of us. I'm going to read you the words of the Rambam. The Rambam is in the 29th parak of Hilchos Shabbos, where he says, Mitzvah saseh min ha-Torah. So listen carefully. Those words of the Rambam, when he introduces this paragraph, he says, Mitzvah saseh min ha-Torah, which is an indication that this is a mitzvah mid-araisa. This is biblical. What is the mitzvah? What is under that heading? Says the Rambam, Lekadesh es yom ha-Shabbos bidvarim. To elevate, to sanctify Shabbos with words. Shenemar, as the Torah says, Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho. And how does one manifest that mitzvah of Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho? Explains the Rambam, Zachreyu zechira shvach v'kiddush. So you have to say something which highlights the special nature, the uniqueness of Shabbos. And therefore, says the Rambam, that is a mitzvah min HaTorah based on the pasuk of Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho. Now the Rambam throws in something very interesting. So far, all he's told us is about Kiddush. But now we move on when the Rambam says, V'tzarech l'zachrehu, and when we talk about this idea of highlighting the uniqueness of Shabbos, says the Rambam, it has to be b'knisaso u'v'yitziyaso. It needs to be on both ends. It needs to be both at the beginning of Shabbos with Kiddush, and at the end of Shabbos with Havdalah. So the Rambam seems to say that this is one overarching principle. This is one mitzvah of Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho means you have to highlight the significance of Shabbos. How do we do that? We do that by making something unique at the beginning of Shabbos, which is the bookend on that side. Then making something unique at the end of Shabbos, which highlights that Shabbos is now over, but Shabbos was unique. And all of that is part of the mitzvah midaraisa of Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho. If we stop here, we would say the mitzvah of Kiddush and the mitzvah of Havdalah are both a mitzvah midaraisa. And that is clear from the words of the Rambam. However, obviously, there are other Rishonim who disagree, and they do not feel that this is the case. Yeah?
Is there a source for this year?
I did not have a chance to make one, but I'm happy to give you everything. It's Perek Chavtes, Hilchos Shabbos Halacha Aleph, where the Rambam says this. And there are other Rishonim who say the same thing. The Magen Avraham quotes this in the name of the Rambam, Siman Reish Tzadi Vav, that the Rambam's opinion is that Havdalah is Midaraisa, based on what we just read. Minchas Chinuch says the same thing. However, there are other Rishonim who disagree. The Rush writes in a tshuva, in the name of Rabbeinu Tam, that this obligation of Havdalah is only a mitzvah midirabbanan. While it's true that Kiddush is a mitzvah min HaTorah because Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho, Havdalah has no connection to Kiddush at all. Kiddush is highlighting the significance of Shabbos when Shabbos begins, Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho. How can that be conflated with Havdalah? What is the connection at all? And that is why the other Rishonim say that this is only a mitzvah midirabbanan. Now, you ask yourself, what is the difference? If it's a mitzvah asay midaraisa, or it's a mitzvah midirabbanan, either way, we have an obligation to observe it. So either we need to say Havdalah on a biblical level or on a rabbinic level, but either way, when Shabbos is over, we need to say Havdalah. The difference is, as is pointed out by many Achronim, the difference is whether women share the obligation to make Havdalah or not. Why would this make a difference? So, if you say that this is part of the mitzvah of Kiddush, so are women obligated in the mitzvah of Kiddush?
Yes.
Why are women obligated in the mitzvah of Kiddush? Isn't it a mitzvah saseh shahazman grama? Isn't Kiddush something that's time-bound? If you make Kiddush on Tuesday afternoon, it doesn't have any meaning. There's no relevance. So why would women share an obligation in Kiddush if it's something that's certainly a time-bound mitzvah? The answer is, the Gemara says in Maseches Pesachim, a few places, the Gemara tells us that we have a hekesh. We have two psukim that say two different things. One is Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho. The other pasuk says Shamar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho. And the two Aseres HaDibros and the two Luchos, we have two different versions. Why is there this discrepancy? Zachar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho highlights all of the positive commandments of Shabbos. Shamar es yom ha-Shabbos lekadesho highlights all of the negative commandments of Shabbos. And the Gemara says, Kol sheyeshna b'shamar, yeshna b'zachar. Whoever has an obligation to observe the negative commandments of Shabbos also shares in the obligation to observe all of the positive commandments of Shabbos. And that is why those two words are interchangeable. Zachar v'shamar, b'dibur echad nemru, to tell you whoever's included in one is included in the other. Now, obviously, women are not allowed to do malacha on Shabbos, even though it's mitzvah saseh shahazman grama. Even though the only time you're not allowed to light a fire is on Shabbos, on Tuesday afternoon, you are allowed to light a fire. But obviously, we only exempt women from positive mitzvah saseh shahazman grama. We don't say that because it's Shabbos, you have a right to do malacha. So once a woman is included in malacha of Shabbos, which is learned from the pasuk of Shamar, we therefore include them automatically in all the positive commandments of Shabbos, which is Zachar as well. And Kiddush would obviously be one of those. Now that the Rambam throws Havdalah into the whole Kiddush discussion, that means that women would have the obligation of not only Kiddush, but also of Havdalah. And that is why the Rambam's opinion is extremely relevant. On the other hand, if you feel that the mitzvah of Havdalah is totally separate from the mitzvah of Kiddush, and they have no connection at all, and it's only midrabanan, then you go back to the regular rule, which is, why would women have that obligation if it's something that really they should not be obligated to do because it is a time-bound mitzvah? Yeah.
But don't we say, for example, that during the week, we mention the names of the week, like Rishon, Sheni, to remember Shabbos the entire week?
Right.
So that if that woman would also be obligated, no?
Okay.
So then it wouldn't make a difference if Havdalah is connected to Kiddush or not.
Meaning, if Havdalah is connected to Kiddush, then all the laws that apply to Kiddush apply to Havdalah as well.
Havdalah is still connected to Zachar.
Correct.
Even if it's not connected to Kiddush.
But that's what Zachar is.
But and then
Zachar is Yom HaShabbos, the Katra, the Rambam says, means saying Kiddush and Havdalah.
It's not, like, for example, Shir Shel Yom or
No, those are further extensions. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, those are further extensions. So that is the discussion among the Rishonim about what is the nature of Havdalah, and it has a very serious implication. Are women obligated in the mitzvah of Havdalah, or perhaps not? So you look in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch can be found in Hilchos Shabbos, Simen Reish Tzadi Vav, Se'if Hei, where the Mechaber writes as follows. Any Sfardim in the room? Yeah, so this makes a big difference. The Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah have a dispute here. How do we paskin? Shulchan Aruch says, Nashim Chayavos B'Havdalah. You know, sometimes you learn the Shulchan Aruch, and you walk out more confused than when you started. Anyone agree with me? Because the Shulchan Aruch will quote an opinion, then he says there are some who argue, then the Ramah says, yeah, but some accept the first opinion and some accept the other. So you walk away and you say, so what am I supposed to do? It's a very good question. So the Shulchan Aruch writes over here, Nashim chayavos b'havdala kishem shechayavos b'kiddush, which is a clear indication that he accepts the opinion of... Nobody's listening. The Rambam, thank you, right? It means it's a clear indication that he accepts the position of the Rambam, that women share the obligation just as they share the obligation in Kiddush. Then he says, V'yesh mishacholek. There are some Rishonim that have an alternative view, that say, no, Havdalah is only midirabanan, and therefore women would not have an obligation. So those are the two opinions in the Shulchan Aruch. Then the Rambam comes along, and he tries to make an easy compromise, and he says, because this is a major dispute in the Rishonim, because the Rambam says women have an obligation, and the other Rishonim say women do not have an obligation, therefore, says the Rambam, we have a good compromise. Why not have a woman listen to Havdalah from a man? That would be the easiest solution. Now, you'll say, it's a very nice solution if there's a man available who's making Havdalah. But what if I'm in a dorm with a bunch of women who do not have a man there, or at least should not have a man in the dorm, and do not have someone available to make Havdalah for them? So what do you do? Right? So it's nice that the Ramah gives this suggestion, but it's not always so practical. And the Mishnah Berurah says there, very clearly, that if that situation does not present itself, if somebody does not have a man there, then you go back to the Ikar HaDin, which is that women should make Havdalah for themselves. The Ramah is only suggesting, why not rely on that and do the compromise to satisfy both opinions of both Rishonim? But if you don't have that opportunity, for whatever reason, then the woman should make Havdalah on her own. And that is a very important psak of the Mishnah Berurah. And often, people make a mistake about this. We have, unfortunately, many women in all of our communities who are widows and who are living alone, for whatever reason, and don't have a man around. They don't have a grandchild in the house. They don't have an extra neighbor who's going to come over every week. And they're always unsure exactly what to do about Havdalah. And very often, you find that they'll skip Havdalah, which is not the correct choice to be made. So what will other people do? Some people will call the children on the phone and listen to Havdalah that they're making in their own home. that also is not the appropriate choice, because the same way we assume doing anything over the phone is usually not the way to be mekayim a mitzvah, right? If I, instead of going to shul, I'm going to decide that I want to participate via a phone call, that's not being mitzarif to the minyan. That's not really something that we generally assume would work. So I always tell the women in our community that although it's very nice to be on the phone with your children on Matzah Shabbos and to listen to their Havdalah and to have all the kids sing, and it's great, and continue to do it, but you should be making Havdalah for yourself if you don't have somebody who comes to your home. Is a woman obligated to go to the next door neighbor and maybe humiliate herself, and not humiliate, but every week she has to go and be dependent on someone else? No, she doesn't have to. What the Ramah says here is, if that option is something that is readily available, something that is comfortable for a person to do, then you do it. If it's not available and it's something that makes them uncomfortable, then of course, you go back to the Ikar Adin, which is that a woman should say Havdalah on her own. Now, there's an old wives' tale, which is that if a woman says Havdalah and drinks the wine, she's going to grow a beard. That has absolutely no source in Halacha whatsoever. So just don't be concerned about that. Yeah?
Why is the Mishnah Berurah that's saying this? Why is it such a chiddush? Like, if she doesn't have, if she's not mechuyav midoraisus, and there's no one there who can, like, there is no men there, she was only chayav midorabanan, so she can just be mechuyav herself.
No, some Rishonim say a woman is not obligated to do it.
Then, if she's not obligated at all, she does not need to go out of her, like, it's, it would be like, die, she would out of her way, but if she's not mechuyav, then she doesn't need to.
Right, but then she should say it on her own.
Right.
So because the Rambam holds that she is obligated to do it. The Mishnah Berurah is just pointing out that the Rambam is just giving a compromise position that a woman should try to do. But if it doesn't work well for her, she shouldn't forget to make Havdalah. She should go back to the Ikar Adin, which is that she's obligated in Havdalah. That's what he says. Yeah?
In general, though, aren't women allowed to make bracha on a mitzvah that they're not chayvin?
So that's a great question. In general, aren't women allowed to make a bracha on a mitzvah that they're not chayvin? You may be surprised to learn, actually, that that is a machlokas Rashi and Tosus. I think it's a Masechah Sukkah. I forgot where. I haven't looked it up in a while. But the Rishonim actually have a dispute. When a woman is not obligated to make a bracha, should she make a bracha anyway? For example, what's a great example? Lulav on Sukkot, right? A woman is not obligated to shake the lulav, but I venture to say everybody in the room tried to, right? You probably tried your best to. Actually, I saw an amazing shiloh over Yontif this past Yontif. In Australia, it's now the winter season, right? So they don't grow any Hadassim and Arabas there now because it's too cold. So they have to import. And this year there was a whole issue with the imports. So there were very, very few Aravos that were coming into town. There was a shul that literally had one set of Dalad Minim that everybody borrowed. Like you heard these stories from Europe back in the days. There was a shul where they had one set of Aravos. And obviously the rabbi who had the set of Aravos and the set of Hadassim, whatever it was, made sure to put it in the fridge when he got home. He wanted to make sure it was going to be preserved for the whole shul to use the next day. His child was taking it out of the refrigerator and, you know, cracked it, and basically the top of the Aravos cracked off, which is Niktam Rosha, which is a problem. So he wanted to know, what does he do? Here he is with the Dalad Minim in Australia, and he doesn't have the opportunity to actually do the mitzvah. Not that that's relevant to anything we just said, but I just thought it was very interesting. So I would venture to say that all of you probably tried your best, because you probably were not in Australia with a shortage of Dalad Minim. So you probably all tried your best to shake the Dalad Minim. As we know, Ashkenazim adopt the opinion of the Rishonim that there's no problem at all to say a bracha, even if I'm not obligated to say it, because I have the right to volunteer to do it. The other Rishonim say, no, that would be a violation. That's a bracha levatela. You're not allowed to do it, and that is the opinion of the Sfardim, that the Sfardim generally do not make a bracha on a mitzvah saseh shahazman grama. If a woman volunteers to do it, great, but she should not recite a bracha, according to the opinion of the Shulchan Aruch, which is the position of the Sfardim. So you're asking that if generally Ashkenazim accept that opinion, then why would this be any different? I think that's a great question. If you want to see a lot more about that, plus the whole background of the beard and the mustache story and where that comes from, there's someone in Eretz Yisrael whose name is Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky. You can Google it later. You'll find his article. He actually published an article in English in the Chakira Journal, which comes out of Brooklyn every couple of months. Very fascinating article. So he published an article there a couple of years ago, which is readily available online, where he goes through the whole history of where this beard, Baba Maisa, started. And also he goes through why it would be the case that we would even think that a woman should not make Havdalah if she makes Havdalah. If she makes any other bracha that she's not obligated to make, why would this be any different? Why would we even suggest that she should listen to a man if we don't suggest that she listens to a man when she shakes lulav? So that is a very good question. But, you know, it could take the whole rest of this year to get into it. Yeah.
So when the Rambam says that Kiddush is like Havdalah, he says about sanctifying the day with words, but not necessarily with wine.
So that's the very next question. So now, what's very unusual about Havdalah, sorry, hold on to that question, yeah?
I don't know if this falls under what you said would take the whole class to explain, but I thought you said that Havdalah is obligated, so then why would there be a dispute whether she should or shouldn't say Havdalah?
There's a dispute in the Rishonim whether or not women have an obligation to make Havdalah, right? So half of the Rishonim say they're not obligated to make Havdalah, the other half of the Rishonim say they are obligated. That's why we accept the compromise opinion that they should listen to a man. The question that was asked was, why is that even a compromise opinion? Why can't she make it on her own the same way she makes a bracha when she shakes a lulav? That's the question. And I think it's a very strong question. It's a great question. Actually, my father in one of his svarim, I think, writes something from Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer, I think, to answer that question. It's a very good question. But in English, if you want to read the whole thing in English, Rabbi Zivitovsky has a whole long article, which is interesting, fascinating, and you can find that. What's very unusual about Havdalah is in the fact that we recite it both in our tefillah on Matzah Shabbos, right? We add a paragraph of Atachon Antanu, as well as when we come home from shul and we finish davening Marv, then we once again recite Havdalah on a cup of wine. So what's that all about? That's something very unusual that we don't generally find. Why do we say it twice, once in the davening and then once again at home? So let's try to understand that. The Gemara says in Maseches Brachos, Daf Lamed Gimel Amid Aleph, that the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah instituted this whole idea of reciting Havdalah, and they told us exactly what to say. Writes the Gemara, in the beginning, when they came up with this idea of Havdalah and which words were supposed to be recited as part of Havdalah, they first instituted it as part of the Tefillah. In the Shmoneh Esrei, they told us to add an additional paragraph into the Shmoneh Esrei that would serve as the Havdalah. Then the Gemara says, He'eshiru, the Jewish community became wealthier, kavua ala kos. Then they said, well, anytime you make a bracha over a cup of wine, it elevates the whole experience. So why should we limit Havdalah to only be something that we recite in davening? Why not elevate Havdalah and say Havdalah over a cup of wine? That will make Havdalah go on to a whole other level. Then the Gemara says, sounds like a great idea. They switched it out of the davening, put it into a cup of wine, and therefore everybody, when they came home, made Havdalah over a cup of wine. Then, Jewish community got poor again, and they weren't able to afford so much wine. So now they were back to the problem. What do we do? Now we don't have wine. All right, let's revert back to the original. What was the original? That we say Havdalah in Shmoneh Esrei. So the Gemara said, what are we going to do? Every couple of years, depending on the economic status of the Jewish community, we're going to decide whether we're going to make Havdalah over a cup of wine or we're going to make Havdalah in the davening. Said the Gemara, as a result of this, they decided everyone has to do both. You have to say Havdalah in the Shmoneh Esrei, and you have to say Havdalah over a cup of wine. If you live in a community where wine is not available, we have an additional option which is referred to as Chamar Medina. You are allowed to use something which is considered a beverage that's a respectable beverage in your community. That would be sufficient for Havdalah as well. Now, how do you determine what is considered Chamar Medina and what is not? That is a great question. The way that the Poskim say it is, basically, if you have a drink that, if you had a respectable guest come into your home, you would offer them such a drink as a guest in your home, that is called Chamar Medina. And that is why, if a person is stuck without wine, you will use, let's say, I think today they say it's soda, orange juice, depends where you live, but something of that nature, you can use for Havdalah as well. But that's why we have both the Havdalah in the Tefillah, and then once again, the Havdalah over a cup of wine. Now, the Ramah says, a woman who very often doesn't daven Maariv on Matzah Shabbos, right? I don't know how many women in the room try to daven Maariv on Matzah Shabbos, but I would venture to say many women do not. So says the Ramah, those women should make sure that before they do any malacha, they have to say Baruch HaMavdil Min Kodesh L'Chol. Either they have to say Havdalah, or at least they have to say something. A man who already said some kind of Havdalah in the Shmoneh Esrei, in Shul, is allowed to do malacha. But a woman who has not yet said any kind of Havdalah has to do something. And says the Ramah, what she needs to say is Baruch HaMavdil Ben Kodesh L'chol. Now the Shari Tshuva actually writes, not the Shari Tshuva, actually there are some Rishonim, the Ra'ah, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim is quoted as saying that maybe as a result of the fact that we add in this paragraph to our Matzah Shabbos davening, maybe it would make sense that we should therefore make an extra concerted effort to daven Maariv on Matzah Shabbos, to be able to do the mitzvah of Havdalah, not only on a cup of wine, but also in the tefillah. That's the Ra'az idea, where he says, even if every other night of the week you're not careful about davening Maariv, but certainly on Matzah Shabbos, he says, maybe we should. That's his opinion, generally not accepted. The Magen Avraham says, women are not so careful to daven Maariv on Matzah Shabbos, and therefore he says, that's fine, but if they want to do malacha, they have to make sure to say, Baruch HaMavda Ben Kodesh L'chol. Now, if a person is davening Shemona Esrei on Matzah Shabbos and forgets to recite that paragraph of Atachon Antanu, of Havdalah, they would not repeat the Shemona Esrei. Why? Because they're about to say it over a cup of wine. So l'chatchila, one should say it in Shemona Esrei and over the cup of wine. If you miss that, if you miss the opportunity to do it, you would not repeat the Shemona Esrei. Now, what generally happens when somebody forgets an insertion in Shemona Esrei, where's the catch-all where you can stick it in? Usually in Shema Kolenu. So, Tosas in Maseches Brachos Daf Chav Tes asks, if a person forgot Atochan Antano, forgot to say that paragraph in the Shemona Esrei, would they add it into Shema Kolenu? Says Tosas, no. No, you would not. Why? Because it's not relevant to Shema Kolenu. Shema Kolenu is, if a person has some kind of request, so then you ask that in Shema Kolenu. Here, you're just saying, Shabbos is over, and I want to be Mavdil ben Kodesh L'chol. But Shema Kolenu is not the relevant place to do that. It has nothing at all to do with the paragraph that talks about Havdalah. And therefore, Tosas says, if you forgot to say Atachon Antanu in the Shemona Esrei itself, you would not add it into Shema Kolenu. There's an important thing to be aware of, that if even though you don't have to repeat Shemona Esrei if you forget Atachon Antanu, you have to remember that if you forgot Atachon Antanu, you're not allowed to do any malacha, which often I find in shul is a big problem. I venture to say every week there are people in shul who forget to say Atachon Antanu, which is okay, but then they drive home, right? They leave their cars in shul, then they drive home from shul. So you have to make sure you're not allowed to do that because you have not yet made any kind of Havdalah. Now, if that's the case, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach raises a fascinating question. If you're in Eretz Yisrael, right? Some of you just came back. How many of you were in Eretz Yisrael for Yontif? I was so jealous when we had the Zoom right before Yontif, and there were a number of people's backgrounds who were, you know, Jerusalem stone. I was wishing I could be there myself. I hope you had a wonderful time. So Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes the following. What happens here in Eretz Yisrael? You have a Jewish taxi driver on Sunday or Matzah Shabbos, and he's not religious. So he didn't make Havdalah. So now you're going to ask him to drive you somewhere. So you're asking him to do malacha before he says Havdalah. How are you allowed to do that? So what do you say? It's an interesting question. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes that he was careful every Matzah Shabbos or Sunday when he got into a taxi. He would first, before he got in, when the taxi driver rolled down the window, he would say Shavua Tov. And then the driver would respond to him, Shavua Tov. Shlomo Zalman said, that's Havdalah. That's the same as saying Baruch HaMavda Ben Kodesh L'chol. When you're saying Shavua Tov, that highlights the fact that Shabbos is over and now it's Chol. Because nobody says Shavua Tov on Shabbos. That's what he argued. Others disagreed with Shlomo Zalman and they said, no. The Rambam, when he talks about Havdalah, tells us that what has to be done is you have to highlight the significance, the uniqueness of Shabbos on both ends. How do we do that? We say Kiddush at the beginning of Shabbos. We say Havdalah at the end of Shabbos, and that shows us that Shabbos is very different. Saying Shavua Tov doesn't really highlight anything significant or unique about Shabbos. All it does is tell us that now it's the beginning of the week. But if you want to be Mekayim, if you want to observe the mitzvah of Havdalah, you have to actually say something that is in celebration of Shabbos itself. And that would not be sufficient to say Shavua Tov. It's similar to what Rabbi Kiva Eger writes on the other end of the spectrum. Say, for example, many women do not daven Friday night, Kabbalah Shabbos and Maariv, right? Many women don't daven. So what happens? All women say Kiddush Friday night. What happens? The husband davens in shul. Then he comes home, and he wants to say Kiddush for his wife. But he, does he have an obligation to say Kiddush now? What? Right, so Mida Raisa, he already took care of his Kiddush. Why? Because he said Kiddush in Shul. Why do you say Kiddush in Shul? When he davened in Shemona Esrei, he spoke about the uniqueness of Shabbos, and that's basically the mitzvah of Kiddush. Now he comes home, he has to say Kiddush for his wife. His wife has a mitzvah Mida Raisa to say Kiddush on her own. Zachor Siyama Shabbos the Kapsho. She didn't daven Maariv yet. So he, who only has an obligation Mida Rabbanan, cannot really be the one to be motzi his wife who has a biblical obligation to say Kiddush. Right? Anyone ever heard of this problem?
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Arevus?
What? So that's a question. Arevus, does Arevus work or not? Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, I have a great suggestion. You know what you do? I think Mishum Shalom Bayis, it's a good idea anyway, without Rabbi Akiva Eiger telling us. I always mention the story how there was someone in our shul, did I tell this here? Someone in our shul who came over to me, he said, I owe your parents everything, my marriage, my Shalom Bayis, like, really, your parents are so helpful to me. I said, okay, interesting, what happened? He said, well, I had a big issue or whatever, and I was talking to your mother today, and your mother told me, you know, you should go to the store, buy your wife some flowers, and when you walk into the house, you know, you should give her the flowers for Shabbos, she'll be so happy. And he said it, like, saved everything amazing. Anyway, he told me, so I said, so what happened? He said, I came home, I presented the flowers to my wife, and I said, Rebbe, since Shechter told me to give you flowers, I'm like, say that, you know, like, you just messed up the whole thing. Anyway, so you know, sometimes if someone gives you a good idea, you should do it anyway, without giving attribution to the person who gave you the idea. So Rabbi Akiva Eiger here says, well, it's a good idea when a husband comes home from shul, he should turn to his wife and say, good Shabbos, sweetheart. He doesn't say the sweetheart part, but he says, you know, like, you should say good Shabbos. Why? This way, your wife has been mekayim, she's observed the mitzvah of Kiddush when she says good Shabbos back to you. Now, it's a nice idea for a husband and wife to greet each other when they come home, when they come into the house. They should say good Shabbos to each other with or without Rabbi Akiva Eiger's problem. With or without the Kiddush issue. It would be nice for them to acknowledge the presence of the other. Rabbi Akiva Eiger says, as far as the Kiddush problem is concerned, by saying good Shabbos, that takes care of it. And other Achronim say, what do you mean? Good Shabbos is enough to be yotzei the mitzvah of Kiddush? Kiddush is, I have to talk about the uniqueness of Shabbos, how special it is, Zechor Siyama Shabbos, the Kadsho. How does saying good Shabbos do anything? That's just saying good morning. It's saying good afternoon, good evening. So now I say good Shabbos. What's the difference? So that's a big question. So there were others who disagreed on Shlomo Zalman. It went a little bit further, I think. Shlomo Zalman also spoke about it, if I'm not mistaken. It says in Shulchan Aruch that before you make Havdalah, you're not allowed to eat anything. Right? So if you're not allowed to eat, the Gemara says in Psachim Daf Kufhei, anyone who eats before Havdalah, very terrible things are going to happen to them. So the Gemara says we should really be careful not to eat before Havdalah. However, the Shulchan Aruch says if someone needs a drink of water, that would be fine. There's no prohibition to drink water before Havdalah. But outside of that, any other food or drink, one should make sure not to have before they recite Havdalah. So, the question that is raised is as follows. If I'm asked as a rabbi to be the Masada Kedushin at a wedding on Sunday, right? So I have a couple, I'm being Masada Kedushin at the wedding. This question only comes up in Israel. Why? Because every marriage has to go through the religious authorities in Israel. That's the only way to have a legalized, recognized marriage in the country. So you have to have a rabbi being Masada Kedushin. So you're having a wedding on a Sunday, and the rabbi is coming to be Masada Kedushin. The couple is not religious, totally unaffiliated. Under the chuppah, the rabbi makes a bori priyah guf, and then he hands a cup of wine to the chassan and the kala to drink. How can he do that? They didn't make Havdalah yet. Right? So that's a very interesting question that is discussed. How do you deal with that? The fact that now by me handing them the cup of wine at their own wedding, I'm now making them eat or drink before they recited Havdalah. Anyway, be it as it may, as we know, every bracha in Shmona Esrei has a specific theme. In fact, in many of the siddurim that we have today, before the bracha, it says one word which basically sizes up what the bracha is going to be about. So let's say, Hashiveinu Avinu L'Sorosecha. On top of it says, oh, that's a terrible example, because on top of it says a word that doesn't really fit. It should say tshuva. I think it says Torah, which is like, you know, whatever. That's not good. But any other, and let's say on top of Baruch Aleinu, it says Parnasa. Right? Because that's really what the bracha is about. So when you look at Atachon Antan, when you look at Atachon in the Adam Das, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us wisdom. He gave us a sense of understanding. Why is that the appropriate place to add in an insertion of Havdalah? What's the connection between Havdalah and the bracha of Atachonein la'adam das? Right? If you were figuring out where this bracha should be placed, where would you have put it? I'm not exactly sure, but I'm not sure why it belongs in Atachonein. So this is a question that is discussed by the Rishonim. Answer number one that they give is because, as we know, on Shabbos there's a halacha, asur la'adam l'tvo tzarachav b'Shabbos. On Shabbos we're not supposed to talk about personal needs in our davening. We're supposed to have Shabbos is taken away, we're not supposed to be worrying about our parnasa on Shabbos, we shouldn't be worrying about other things on Shabbos. Shabbos is supposed to be a spiritual time in our lives, which is really supposed to shelter us from the worries of the rest of the week. And therefore, we're not supposed to insert our own bakashas on Shabbos that have to do with our mundane lives. Once Shabbos is over, we're about to say the entire Shemona Esrei. And what happens in the Shemona Esrei? We ask our Kadosh Baruch Hu, Baruch Aleinu Hashem Elokeinu, give us a parnasa, give us a refuah, give us this, give us that, give us everything in our lives. We ask our Kadosh Baruch Hu for so many different things. What gives us the license to begin to ask all of that? Well, before we make the first ask, before we say Chonein Hadas, which is really the first ask that we have in the Shemona Esrei, we first need to say Shabbos is now over, which now gives us the right to go into all the different requests that we have throughout the duration of the Shemona Esrei. And that is why, just technically, Havdalah has to be in the very first bracha of Shemona Esrei. Obviously, the first three brachos are not really a bakasha. You're not asking for anything. You're just praising Hashem. Then when you get to the first bracha, which is asking for something, we have to first make a demarcation by saying, Shabbos is over, we recited Havdalah, and now we're going to go into all the other brachas of Shemona Esrei. Let me just say the other reason, and then I'll get to your question. The second reason that the Rishonim give is a very intriguing reason, where they say, Im ein das Havdalah minayin. We talk about Hamaldu ben Kodesh l'chol, ben Or l'choshech, ben Yisrael l'amen. We talk about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu separated between this, between that, between the Jewish people and the rest of the world, between day and night, between different days of the week, and between Shabbos. If a person doesn't have das, if someone doesn't have a sense of understanding, how will you ever make a Havdalah? Take, for example, if you have a child, a young child sometimes picks something off the floor, puts it into their mouth. Why do you put it in your mouth? Don't you see it's a piece of a game? Why are you putting a card into your mouth? Why are you putting a piece of a game into your mouth? Why are you putting a battery into your nose? It's because they don't have enough das to understand, well, this is not a cookie. This is not a candy. This is not food. So they don't have enough understanding to know the difference between this and that, to know what's healthy, what's not healthy, to know what's dangerous, what's not dangerous. Im ein das, havdala minayin. If a person doesn't have a mature sense of understanding, then you're really not going to know how to make a separation, a delineation between X and Y. And therefore, this is the appropriate place to put Havdalah in the Shemona Esrei, because we say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, thank you for giving me Das. Atah Chonein La'Adam Das. You gave me the ability to think. You gave me the ability to have an understanding. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us a mind where we have the ability as human beings to make decisions and to do good things. As a result of that, we say, we know how to make a difference between Yisrael La'Amim, Ben Kodesh L'Chol, Ben Or L'Choshech, Ben Sheish Yisimei Amaseh. All of that is dependent on the fact that we have das. And therefore the Rishonim say, Emein das, havdala minayin. That's what it's all about. Yeah, you had a question.
I might have missed it, but did you give an answer to why a man who's obligated to Rabbanan is allowed to give
a douche for a wife who's Jehovah? So Rabbi Kiv Eger, as I mentioned, Rabbi Kiv Eger says that what we should do is we should wish our spouses, when we come into the house, we should say a good Shabbos. By doing that, and the wife responds, she's now acknowledging that it's Shabbos, and she's taking care of her biblical obligation of saying Kiddush on Shabbos. And now you're both on the same level playing field. The husband and the wife are both only obligated midrabbanan to say Kiddush over a cup of wine. That's what he suggests.
That's enough.
What? That's what he says. Others disagree, and they say, how can that be enough? That's not Kiddush. That's just saying good Shabbos. That's nothing. So some say that idea of Arvus that was brought up, that we all have an obligation to make sure that we perform mitzvos, and men have an obligation to make sure that everybody performs mitzvos, women have an obligation to make sure everybody, so that's what some suggest, different ideas. Okay, so I don't know, anyone in the room have the custom to say any of the Zmiros on Matzah Shabbos? Right, there's a whole, if you look in the back of the Siddur, there are a whole bunch of Zmiros to say on Matzah Shabbos. So one of them that you probably have heard before, Hamavdim and Kodesh Lachol, Chatusenu Hu Yimchol, Zarenu V'Chaspenu Yarbek Achol. Don't you think that's interesting? Think about those words. We just made Havdalah. We thanked HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us Das, for giving us intellect, for giving us an understanding, for giving us perspective. As a result of this perspective that we have, we know how to differentiate between Kodesh Lachol, Or L'Choshech, Yisrael La'Amim, Sheish Yisimei Amaseh, all of that, we get it. What's the first thing we ask? Hamavdim and Kodesh L'chol. Thank you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You make a Havdalah, you make a separation between Kodesh and Chol, between all of the above. Chatosenu Yimchol. Zareinu V'chaspenu Yarbek Achol. Can there be a more convoluted head than somebody who says, I should have a lot of children and a lot of money? It's like you're showing how little of an understanding that you have of how to make a Havdalah, if you lump in your children and your money together. So this is the question that Rav Schwab asks in one of his Sfarim. How is it that after we celebrate the fact that we have Das, and that we have the ability to discern the difference between X and Y, we then go ahead and do something which shows how we don't really have an understanding at all? And we say, Zareinu v'chaspeinu yarbe kachol. It sounds like such a strange thing to say. So Rav Schwab suggests as follows, and it's so beautiful. He says, there's nothing inherently wrong with money. The world can't run without money. We all need money to take care of ourselves and our children and our families and our communities. Of course we need money. Money can also be very destructive. If somebody misuses money, if somebody abuses their money, if somebody takes their position as a result of the money that they've made and corrupts that power, then obviously money can be something that is very destructive. So he says this fits exactly into Hamavdim and Kodesh Lachol. We say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we understand children in our lives are so valuable. But Zareinu v'chaspeinu yarbe kachol, we say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you give us a lot of money, we also will know how to make a Havdalah in how we spend our money. In fact, Rav Schwab writes that the Medrash says when HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructed Moshe Rabbeinu to take a machzis HaShekel, Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't exactly sure what the Ribbono Shel Olam meant. So it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed him a matbea shel esh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed him a coin that had fire around it. So a lot of Mefarshim try to figure out what's the significance of the matbea shel esh. So Rav Schwab writes, perhaps the understanding here is, what's the matbea shel esh all about? It's because fire can have two different qualities. Fire can be very destructive. Fire can burn down a house, can burn down a city. Fire can destroy people, destroy lives, destroy families. On the other hand, where would our world be without fire? We wouldn't be able to drive cars, and we wouldn't be able to cook any food, and we wouldn't be able to have all the wonderful pleasures that we have without fire. So it goes in both directions. On the one hand, fire can be something that is extremely helpful and very beneficial to the world. On the other hand, fire, if it's not used properly, can be something that is extremely destructive. As a result of that, HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed Moshe Rabbeinu a matbea. He showed him money in Eish, matbea shel Eish, and he said to him, understand, the same way that fire can be used in both ways, so too money can also be used in both directions. You can use your money to further the cause, to advance the good causes in the world, or you can use your money to bring about corruption in the world and support terrible things and promote things that should not be promoted. And therefore, we say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Zareinu v'chaspeinu yarbe kachol. It's exactly that, says Rav Schwab. Now that I celebrate the fact that I know how to be mavdil between different aspects and elements of my life, now I also appreciate the fact that money works in the same way. Money can be something that is used to enhance lives. Money can be something that is used to absolutely destroy lives at the same time. So this is with regard to that tefillah that we say after Havdalah, and that is the significance of that line of Zareinu v'chaspeinu yarbe kachol. There is a discussion in Tosas and Maseches Brachos, Daf Mem Gimel, where he talks about when one person is reciting Havdalah. So, is this something that should be said while everyone is sitting, or is it something that should be said while everyone is standing? So, how many people in the room, everybody sits down for Havdalah? Anybody do that? You do? Really? Okay, so Tosas discusses it. Why would you sit down for Havdalah? What's that all about? You ever thought about it? You didn't think about it because that's just what you do, right? So no need to think about it.
And we're all part of the same group.
What?
We all belong to the same group.
Correct. So Tosas writes as follows. Tosas says that the reason to sit is a very compelling argument. If one person is going to say the bracha on behalf of all of us, right, and we all want to be yotzei together with that one person, we have to show that we're all part of one designated group and that we're all paying attention to this person's bracha that's being recited on our behalf. How do we do that? By all sitting down together around the table and showing that all of us are paying attention. All of us stop whatever we're doing. We have nowhere to go. We have nothing to be busy with. Right now, we're all sitting down and listening to the one person at the head of the table, whoever that may be, who's going to do Havdalah for everybody who's sitting around. There's a reason that we all sit. My father's actually very makbid that Tosas actually writes this, but not everyone's so careful. Shabbos morning sometimes, or Friday night, when you have many people at the table, so people are washing, people are, you know, it takes a while, it takes a few minutes for everyone to wash, come back. So sometimes the person who's making hamotzi will recite hamotzi lechem and aretz before everybody's seated around the table. Some people are still in the kitchen, they washed already, but they're not sitting down. So my father is actually of the opinion, not everyone agrees, but he's basing it on the same idea of Tosfos, that if you don't have everyone sitting around the table at the time of the Hamotzi, then they can't be Yotzei the Bracha together with the person who's making it, because you have to show we're having a Kvias together, that we are all joining together to be Yotzei the Mitzvah together with you. So that's what Tosfos says. That's why there would be a compelling argument for everyone to actually be seated during Havdalah as a way of demonstrating very publicly that all of us want to be Yotzei the Mitzvah of Havdalah together with the one person who's designated to say the words of Havdalah. On the other hand, 98% of the women in the room today mentioned or voted that they say Havdalah standing. So what's that all about? Why do we do that? So the Orchas Chaim writes as follows. Orchas Chaim is also one of the Rishonim where he says, well, what's the reason why we say Havdalah? Havdalah is at the very end of Shabbos. We're basically thanking Shabbos for coming, and we usher the Shabbos out. When was the last time you had a guest in your house? When they were ready to leave, you're sitting on your couch. All right, nice to have you. You know, you just let them leave. That's not the way we treat our guests. What do? We all stand up. We walk them to the door. We help them with their packages. We do whatever needs to be done to help them and to show them how much we are excited about the fact that they spend time with us. Therefore, says the Orchas Chaim, if that's the way we would treat any guest who comes to our home, well, then that's the way we should usher Shabbos out of our homes as well. And therefore, he says, it's significant that we should actually stand during Havdalah to show, out of respect to Shabbos and the fact that Shabbos is leaving our home, we go out of our way to stand during Havdalah, even though there would be a very compelling argument to be seated during Havdalah in order to make a kvius that we should all be together. Yeah, question.
So for Kiddush also, like, would there be anyone to say they have to sit to look?
Yes, so by Kiddush for sure. Kiddush for sure, the reason to sit is even more. The Poskim say by Kiddush, it's not only because we're supposed to have a kvius together, but even beyond that, it's because you need to have Kiddush b'makom su'uda. Kiddush b'makom su'uda means you need to show that the Kiddush is connected to the meal you're about to eat. Now, if you're going to say Kiddush in the kitchen, and then everyone's going to come sit down later, that's not Kiddush b'makom su'uda. That's something that really doesn't demonstrate that. And that's why by Kiddush, you're definitely supposed to be seated. However, you're wondering, everybody stands up by Kiddush Friday night, correct? Oh, so we're getting, you're all correct. Some are shaking their heads, yes, we stand by Kiddush Friday night. Some are saying, no, we sit by Kiddush Friday night. The answer is you're all right. In Shulchan Aruch, there are actually four opinions about sitting or standing by Kiddush Friday night. Now you ask yourself, how can there be four opinions about somebody that only has two options? Either you stand or you sit, right? So what are the four opinions?
Sit in the middle.
Sit in the middle. So that's three opinions. What's four opinions? What? Let's say Friday night, there's four opinions in Shulchan Aruch. Shabbos day, everyone agrees you should sit down. So the four opinions in Shulchan Aruch are as follows. The easiest are the first two. Either you sit the whole time or you stand the whole time out of respect to Shabbos. Okay. What are the middle opinions? One opinion says you only stand for the first paragraph, Ha'ichud HaShemayim V'Haaretz, but once it comes to Baruch Priyar Gafen, then everyone sits down to make a kvias once again. The fourth opinion is that you only stand up for the first few words. What are the first few words? Yudke Vavke, Vayer Vayivoker, right? No, this is not advanced gematrias here. This is Vayer Vayivoker, is Yud Hey Vav Hey. And as a result of that, some say that out of respect to the Shem Hashem, so you stand up just for that, and then you sit for the rest. That's what it's about. Actually, in Shulchan Aruch, it says that when you recite the Kiddush, you're supposed to look at the candles. And that is why you should try to have the candles in some kind of close proximity to where you're going to have the Shabbos meal, so that you can have the opportunity not only to enjoy the ambiance of the Shabbos candles, but also that during Kiddush, you should be able to look at the candles at some point when you say the Kiddush itself. Okay? So far, so good? Okay, so one of the last things that we're going to talk about, I see the shiur is almost over, one of the last things we need to talk about is, part of the Havdalah on Matzah Shabbos is when we recite the bracha of Borei Ma'orei Ha'esh. So what is that all about? Why do we say Borei Ma'orei Ha'esh? So this is a little bit relevant to this week's Parsha. So as we know, Tchilas Briyaso, when was Adam HaRishon created? When was Adam HaRishon created? What day of the week? What? It's not a trick question. Friday, right? Okay. Then he observed Shabbos. What happened on Shabbos?
Nothing.
What?
Nothing.
Shavas vayinafash, right? So he, not nothing, something special, but nothing active. So the Medrash says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, at the beginning, at that time, when the first Matzah Shabbos was coming into being, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed Adam HaRishon. It says that Adam HaRishon was a little bit concerned. He saw that the sun was setting. He thought it had to do with the fact that he did this terrible Avera. He ate from the Eitz Hadas. He didn't know what it was going to be. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu at that time took two Avanim, took two stones, flint stones, and he rubbed them against the other, and he showed Adam HaRishon how to make a fire. So this is a fascinating story recorded in the Medrash Rabbah. It's in the Bereishis Rabbah, this week's Parsha. By Yivarech Elokim as Yom HaShvi. Pasuk says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave a bracha on the seventh day. What was the bracha? Torah doesn't say. What bracha did he give? So the Medrash says, Bameh Berchu. In what way was the seventh day of the week, was Shabbos, actually blessed? What did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do on Shabbos that made it unique than any other day of the week? Says the Medrash, HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed it with light, with aur. That he gave Adam HaRishon the ability to learn how to light a fire. And that's really where this idea comes from, that we start our week off by saying Bari Mari Ha'esh to highlight the fact that this is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu put the ability for man to create light in the world. So that is what we thank him for. So the Rashba asks in a tshuva, so why is it that we make the bracha on Matzah Shabbos on light? What's the question? What should we do? What? No, we should say Matzah Shabbos makes sense, but he says, why don't we say every day of the week a bracha on when everything was created? Right? So every Sunday we should make a bracha on the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Shemayim Ba'aretz. Every Monday we should make a bracha, so why Matzah Shabbos? Like, this seems very arbitrary. So yes, it's true, HaKadosh Baruch Hu on Matzah Shabbos showed Adam HaRishon how to make a fire. But is that a good enough justification for us to be making a bracha every single week of Bori Mari Ha'esh? So the Rashba answers that it's more than that. It's not just that this is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu taught him how to make a fire, and we commemorate that. It's more than that. It's the fact that on Shabbos, we're not allowed to use a fire. And now is the first opportunity that we have to do malacha once again. As a result of that, says the Rashba, we therefore have the bracha of Borei Ma'ori Ha'esh, because we go back to the original allowance that we had to use fire before Shabbos began, and by Shabbos now being over, we go back to that ability that we had before Shabbos began. So that is the way the Rashba explains what this fire is all about. And that's why on Matzah Yom Kippur we do it as well. Right? You ever wonder, how come on Matzah Yom Tov we don't make Borei Ma'ori Ha'esh? But on Matzah Yom Kippur we do. Why would he do it on Matzah Yom Kippur? The answer is, says the Rashba, because on Yom Kippur you're not allowed to light a fire. On Yom Kippur you're not allowed to light a fire. And therefore, after Yom Kippur is over, we highlight the fact that, oh, now we are allowed to revert back to that which we were allowed to do before Yom Kippur. Whereas on Yom Tov, a fire is allowed to be lit. And that's why after Yom Tov, we do not make the bracha of Borei Ma'ori Ha'esh. Now, the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos Daf Nun Aleph Amid Beis, Ein Mevarchen Al Haner, Ad She'usu La'oro. You're not allowed to make a bracha on a candle on Matzah Shabbos unless ad she'usu la'oro, until you have benefit from its light. Till you have benefit from its light. Now the Gemara says, do you actually have to benefit, or it's just that it has to be enough light that you would potentially be able to benefit, but not that you actually have to be close enough that you're benefiting from it? So the Gemara says, well, how light does it have to be? Writes the Gemara, well, there are two different coins. One is called a sela. One is called a pundion. These are coins from the days of the Gemara. Let's say a nickel and a dime. Two different kinds of coins. And you have to have enough light that you'd be able to tell the difference between a sela and a pundion. So how many of you have ever seen a sela and a pundion? Any of you have these coins in your house? I assume not, right? So these are archaeological discoveries that they have in Israel. But who knows what a sela and a pundion is? So actually, if you want to see it once, and lots of other fascinating things and fascinating people, there's a museum in Brooklyn called the Living Torah Museum. Anyone ever been there?
Yeah.
It's an amazing place. That place is amazing.
We went together.
You went together?
With
great place to visit. Very cool guy who runs it. His name is Reb Shaul Shimon Deutsch. He's a Lubavitcher Chassid. Very, very interesting person. A great Talmud Chacham. Knows history, knows a lot of different things, and he somehow collects shipwrecks and all kinds of strange things, and he has a whole farm of animals in there also. I don't know, he just has a lot going on in the middle of Borough Park. So in there, he once showed us, I actually once took my father and Rev Meir Twersky and Rev Usher Weiss. So it was like, it was a very interesting trip. So he decided when we were there, like, oh, I'm going to give you the rabbi tour. So I'm going to show you like things that you would appreciate. So he didn't show them like all the animals, all different things. He showed them like things that the Gemara talks about. So he said, oh, where does the Gemara ever say about a Sela and a Punyon? Of course, all of them knew right away. Yeah, the difference, you know, how do you know Abdullah? So he showed them the two coins. He showed them, this is a Sela, this is a Punyon. My father literally had to like take his glasses off to see the difference. What is the difference? One of them has somebody riding on a horse, and the horse has like two little things coming out of its head, and the other one does not have the things coming out of its head. That is the difference between a Sela and a Punyon. It wasn't until I saw that that I'm like, wow, this Gemara actually feels that you need to have a real fire for Matzah Shabbos when you make the bracha of Borei Ma'ori Ha'esh. Very interesting. But be it as it may, what's clear is you're supposed to have a candle that is Asi L'Ha'er. You have to have a candle that is made to really give light. That's what is supposed to be used. Now, my father, based on that comment to the Gemara, is careful to turn the lights off on Matzah Shabbos when we say Borei Ma'ori Ha'esh, because this way you can really have benefit from the candle. If you have the electric lights on, then what good did it do by lighting this candle, this torch? It doesn't really add anything to the light that's in the room. So that's generally what my father does, which is a nice chumrah. Obviously, you don't have an obligation to do it, but it would make sense based on what the Gemara says. Now, in general, we have three basic categories of brachos that we are confronted with during our experience of making brachos. Sometimes we have a bracha which is referred to as a birchas hanehanin. Sometimes we have a bracha which is referred to as a birchas hashevach. And sometimes we have a bracha which is referred to as a birchas hamitzvah. What are these three categories? What are they? A birchas hanehanin means I have benefit from something, and I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for allowing me to have benefit. That's category number one, birchas hanehanin. Category number two is birchas hashvach, which means I'm so amazed by something that I see in the world, by the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I have to say a bracha just to express my appreciation for what it is that I see, that I feel, that I experience. That's a birchas hashvach. And the third category is what we refer to as a birchas hamitzvah, which means before I do any mitzvah, I have to recite a bracha. Asher kedshanu mitzvos v'tzivanu lahadlik ner shel Chanukah. Al mikra megillah, lishma kol shofar, all the different brachas, those are birchas hamitzvah. Okay? Three categories clear. Birchas hanenin, birchas hashevach, birchas hamitzvah. Is there a difference between these three categories of brachas? Is there a difference? The answer is, of course, there's a difference. The Gemara says in Maseches Pesachim Daf Zayin that whenever I'm about to observe a mitzvah, I have to make a bracha over la'asiyasa, which means before I observe the mitzvah, I have to make a bracha. This is almost like what allows me to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu and shake the Dalet Minim or light his Hanukkah candles. What allows me to do that, or what frames what I'm about to do, is when I say the bracha, Asher Kedushan Mitzvah Sivana, I'm doing this only because you instructed me to do so. So that's a birchas hamitzvah. Okay, now, birchas hanenin, as we said, is something that you recite when you have pleasure, when you're about to derive benefit or pleasure from something in the world. Do you make that bracha before or after? All those who say before, raise your hands. Right? So let's say I'm about to enjoy the Snapple that I have back there. So I make a bracha before I drink it. Why? So the Gemara says, if I don't make a bracha before enjoying that pleasure, it's as if I've stolen from the property of the Ribono Shel Olam himself. So I have to recite a bracha before I eat, before I drink, before I get any pleasure, because that's what allows me to get that pleasure. Okay, now here's the third category, which is a birchas hashevach. What's a birchas hashevach? Anyone ever made a birchas hashevach in their lives? Yeah?
Rainbow.
Rainbow. Or? Birchas agomo, good, okay. Give me a different one.
Thunder.
Thunder, lightning. You see an ocean, you see a beautiful mountain, you see something amazing, so you make a birchas hashevach. Now, the way that works is, I first see the Grand Canyon, I'm so blown away by what I see. In reaction, in response to what I've seen or experienced, I then make a birchas hashevach. So that's categorically different than the other two we said. Birchas hamitzvah has to be before the mitzvah. Birchas hanenin has to be before I derive the pleasure or benefit from the food or drink that I'm now enjoying. A birchas hashevach is something that I say after I experience this great moment, this great wonder, this unbelievable experience of the Grand Canyon or the Niagara Falls or anything like that, then I respond by saying a Birchas HaShavach. So you ask yourself, when I have the bracha on Matzah Shabbos of Borei Ma'orei Ha'esh, what kind of bracha is that? Is that category 1, category 2, or category 3? So it's definitely not a Birchas HaMitzvah, right? I don't say Asher Kedushanam in Mitzvos HaVitzivanu before I look at the candle. So it's not a Birchas HaMitzvah. So that's out. So what is it? Is it a Birchas HaShvach or a Birchas HaNenet? What would you say?
To distinguish between the two types of coins that you're having.
So which one is it?
Net.
So it's a Birchas HaNenet. So what should I do?
Say the bracha before.
You're saying I should first make the bracha, and only then should I look at the candles, right? On the other hand, if it's a Birchas HaShevach, which is that I'm thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu for this ability to use fire and to use light and to bring it into my life and to be helpful to me, then I would first derive the benefit from the candles, only afterward would I recite the bracha. Correct? Is that making sense? So that is a big dispute among the Rishonim. What is the right way to do this? Would we say that a person should first make the bracha and only then look at the candle and derive the benefit? Or should it be the opposite? Should I first derive the benefit and then I'm so overwhelmed by this incredible gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us of light that now I will make the bracha the same way I would after seeing the Grand Canyon, after seeing the Yam HaGadol, after seeing Niagara Falls or anything like that. So after seeing the ability that fire has to enhance my life, I'm then going to respond by making a bracha which is referred to as a Birchas HaShevach. The Mishnah Berurah says, surprisingly, that you should first be mistakel b'ner, you should first look at the candle, and only then should you make the bracha. Now you're going to look like the weirdo if you get home this Shabbos, and that's what you do, right? That before whoever makes Havdalah in your home, before they make Havdalah, you're going to be going like this, and only then you're going to make the bracha. But the Mishnah Berurah says that's what one is supposed to do. So that's the way my father does it at home as well, that all of us first look at the candle, then you make the bracha, Borei Ma'orei Ha'esh, afterward. Now, you can do both. You can go like this, and you can also do it afterward. There's no harm in that. But that's really what it's about. I wouldn't make a big scene of it in your home. It's actually a dispute in the Rishonim. What exactly is this Birchas Borei Ma'orei Ha'esh? What's it all about? But I think it's an interesting point to be aware of, that the whole point of dispute is trying to figure out, is it a Birchas HaNenin or a Birchas HaShevach? And the difference will be whether you should first make the bracha and then derive the benefit, or you should first derive the benefit and then make the bracha. As mentioned, the Mishnah Berurah says you should first derive the benefit and only then make the bracha, which indicates that this is a Birchas HaShevach. I'm overwhelmed by this creation of light, and therefore I thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for what he's put into my life. You had a question? Someone had a question?
Yeah. Yeah. If you are like in a big area where someone's taking Havdalah and you can hear them and you know they're having marquee moments, and you, but there's like the lights are on or the lights are off, but there's just no way that you're benefiting off of that. So you know you're not going to be going to that bracha.
You can go over after.
And like just light it on fire or whatever?
Yeah, or just walk over to the candle.
If you can't get to that candle, but like, should you do it on your own?
You can definitely do it on your own. And I'll add into this, I think that you can definitely do it on an electric light. You can do it on an electric bulb, provided that you can actually see the filament. Because if you can't see the filament, the poskim say that wouldn't work. Now, nowadays, that's a little bit hard because most of our lights don't have a filament. They just have an LED. What is a filament? You don't even know?
No.
Right? Okay. Like in the old light bulbs that everyone used to use before LEDs, so it actually had like a hot coil in there, right? Like that lit up. That's the way they used to make fire. Like old light bulbs used to be hot. Remember that?
Yes.
So why were they hot? What were they hot about? They were hot because there was an actual fire inside. So this is relevant. I guess at some point we should probably talk about Hadlakas Neir Shabbos. So we're going to have to talk about that when this comes up there as well, because it's relevant not only by Havdalah, but also by Kiddush. I'm sorry, also by Hadlakas Neir Shabbos. So I think in one of the Svarim it says that Reb Chaim Ozer, who was the big posik in Europe before the war, Reb Chaim Ozer specifically used to use an electric light bulb on Matzah Shabbos for Havdalah. He did that in order to prove to everyone in his community that he believed that electricity is an Issur D'Oraisa on Shabbos. So he said, if I use it and I show that this is exactly like fire, then people will extrapolate from that that the same way on Shabbos you're not allowed to light a fire, you're also not allowed to turn on the lights. There were people who said, no, turning on the lights is not an extension of electricity, is not an extension of a fire. That's totally different. Those aren't similar at all. So I think they say Reb Chaim Lozer went out of his way on Matzah Shabbos to show that, no, this really is a malacha on Shabbos. To turn on the lights would be a real malacha of the same way that I'm not allowed to make a fire, I'm not allowed to turn on the lights either. And to demonstrate that, they say that he used to use it for Havdalah in order to prove his point. Okay, so we'll